will review Volo's Guide to Monsters.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Unreliable Narrators.
Yes. Well, welcome to our nice fireside podcast, where, as opposed to our general, you know, history talks and world building.
Certainly. We're going to be reviewing someone else's history talks and world building.
Yeah, we're going to be reviewing one of... I know we said we'd do this about a year ago.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we're going to be going over Volo's Guide, finally, as promised.
Yes. Sorry it took so long.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe there will be a new Monster Manual review in a couple of months that we can wait a year to review.
You're not joking, are you?
No, I'm not. Oh boy. But yeah. What's the basic rundown of what Volo's Guide is? What's the concept?
All right. Well, Volo's Guide is basically a new monster manual of a sorts, supposedly, and you can't see it, but I'm doing air quotes, written by a character named Volo, who's a relatively famous fighter in-universe, and he goes about and does research on different monsters and kinds of monsters and brings them back to the High God Wizard Elminster.
Yeah.
I don't think that's his actual title, but that's what they call him anyway.
Yeah, well, fuck him. Fucking Elminster.
I have limits. But...
listen, he knows Polymorph. You know he knows Polymorph.
Shit.
Anyways.
All right, gotta stop being distracted. Wow. Yeah. The idea is that it goes a little more in-depth into some history and biology and physiology of certain monsters and different kinds of monsters. It starts off leading with big lists of over-species, I guess, you know, things like beholders or giants or kobolds, and going in-depth about them for a few pages, then switching over to a new one and a new one. And after that section, it just lists, in a traditional Monster Manual fashion, stat blocks and small bits and pieces about things.
Yeah. Think of it as, you know, instead of having a dedicated Draconomicon book or a dedicated Kobold splat book or something.
Right.
They're taking the Monster Manual model, and they are basically, you know, including large kind of, 3 to 15 page sections on a particular monster's habits, culture, lairs, philosophy, that kind of thing.
It feels almost like a collection of Dragon Magazine articles.
Yes, definitely.
In fact, I think that might actually be what it's based on.
Yeah. I think it is halfway between kind of the Dragon model for fleshing out different monsters and cultural ideas,
mm-hmm.
and things like, you know, the kind of bigger splat books of the third edition era, and to an extent they still had them in the fourth edition era too.
Certainly.
Of things like, you know, instead of having just a book on the Feywild or a book on the elemental planes, they're gonna focus more on, you know, instead of focusing on thematics, they're just going to be like, hey, we know you want monsters. Here's a bunch of monsters, and we're going to give you a little write-up on several of them.
Right. And to be honest, when this was first announced, I was very excited for this.
Well, I was a little misled. The way that they specifically advertised what this book was going to be, it seemed a little bit more like, what was that, that 40K novel, Xenology? The way that they kind of, said that it was going to be is it was going to be very subjective. It was going to be, there was going to be a heavy author's voice and a heavy notation aspect to it.
Right.
And you do get that. There are kind of notes that are, like, kind of appended to the physical pages.
Certainly.
Or whatever, from Elminster or Volo or whatever.
Yes.
But by and large, the kind of diction and language, the Volo's Guide is written in, is the same diction you would find in the Monster Manual.
Yes, it is very much just a Monster Manual with a few things tacked on.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, where I was going to get at. I wasn't so much misled as I hyped myself up for it.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Definitely, the way that they advertised it, it definitely sounded like it was going to be a lot more, like, a lot of, like, the philosophical and cultural ideas were going to be given to you via diary-like fluff pieces.
Yes.
And then appended with notes and, you know, statistical blocks and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But, I mean, it's basically, it's going to be, if that's what you're expecting, it's going to be a lot more like a Draconomicon or a, a Demonomicon or, or one of those kinds of books.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And as one of those, it does very well.
Yes.
I will 100% say this is a solid addition to a 5th edition library.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of one of my bigger points that I never really bought into those style of books is like, yeah, like I want some more information on dragons. I want some more information on demons. I want more information on a particular plane. But I don't want to buy into a 100 to 200 page book that's all about that. And that's kind of the nice thing about this book is that you know, let's say, oh, I really don't give a crap about, you know, orcs.
Right.
Well, orcs are, while there is a very nice, thick section on orcs, there isn't a huge section on orcs.
Yes.
Or, like, let's say, you know, you're running, I don't know, you're running, like, a, you're running a pirate campaign. You're probably really not going to be able to use giants all that much.
At all.
But there's plenty of other stuff in this book that you will definitely be able to use that the rather large section devoted to giants isn't going to feel like a big hit on your wallet when you buy it.
Right. This is very much an all-purpose thing. You can find something to use in here, almost guaranteed. I, on the other hand, just like buying books.
Yeah.
I love expanding my big old stupid-ass collection of role-playing game books.
It is very nice. You do have Exalted 2nd Edition in there, so...
Yeah, I do. Nobody's perfect. But, again, this is a very solid edition. It's a nice-looking book. It has, if you ask me, great art, if a little edgy.
Yeah. It's a... I like the way that the 5th edition kind of art direction is developing. It doesn't have that highly lined illustrative quality that Pathfinder has that I do admittedly like.
Okay.
But I like that it's pushing itself away from that and not just riding on the coattails of that.
Which is very nice.
Yeah. But it is also, it's all very, very, very consistent, which is, if I had any complaint about 4th edition or 3rd edition's art, is the utter inconsistency from one piece to another.
It's okay. We can say chaos.
Yeah.
It was utter chaos.
Yeah.
Which I didn't mind, because I liked seeing the variation, different people's takes on different things. However, there's something to be said for consistency.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess the way that we're basically going to break this episode down is there are three major kind of sections of this book. There is a section that goes into several different creatures, kind of societies.
Right.
There's a section that gives a bunch of statistics for using different creatures or monster races as player races.
Yes.
So we'll cover that as a different section.
Yes.
And then there's a big, fat, old, regular-ass bestiary section, which we will loosely go through whatever monsters we kind of felt like mentioning from there.
Yes. Basically, there's a Dragon Magazine portion, there's a Monster Manual portion, and then there's a DM's Guide portion.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a dragon/dungeon magazine portion,
yes.
There's a dungeon/dragon magazine portion, and then there's the monster manual.
Yes, you are completely right. Where should we begin?
Let's start from the top. The first thing that's covered is beholders.
All right, didn't see that coming.
Yeah, and to a point, if you've listened to the beholders episode, at this point, you know, when we covered Beholders, this was already out, and we did reference this for the Beholders episode.
We did, because it provided a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, but the Beholders section is, it's good. It's really good.
It honestly is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, even the name of it, Beholders, Bad Dreams Come True.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to harp on the whole, I said it was going to be good before it came out, but I mean, I knew that if anything in this book was going to be good, the Beholder section was going to be.
And buddy, you were right.
Yeah. Because that is, you know, they're a highly iconic D&D character, and it is nice to see them, you know, get a full write-up like this for 5th edition.
It really is. And you are, again, completely right. They are fully iconic.
Yeah. The, I guess, kind of like the big thing that they kind of get into is if you play a game in Faerun, they do particularly go into the Xanathar.
Yes.
And that the nature of that whole Thieves Guild that's run by a beholder.
Yes.
They really, really lean heavily into the whole idea that the kind of Azathoth dreamer kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
where their minds are so powerful that they do alter reality.
Yes.
Which is a thing that I, as a DM, don't really know how to wrap my head around, but that's because I am a simpleton.
Nah, man. Nah. It's weird stuff.
Yeah.
It is. But if you can pretend to understand it, it's good.
Yeah.
Like, it's an impressive thing for your players to try and work out.
Yeah. There's really nothing we can really add to the beholders really commented on that we didn't talk about in the episode.
Yes.
The only minor complaint that I have is that, the explanation for beholders breeding in this,
mm-hmm.
Really, really absolutely like comes down to when they dream, they can make a beholder in their dreams, but that always usually ends with the two beholders fighting to the death.
Yes.
Which still doesn't explain how there is any kind of a positive population growth for beholders.
Right. I don't think there is.
Yeah.
At all. I really don't. Oh, and one last thing. I said it before, but I really, really love all the random generation for beholders.
Oh yeah, no, like that's one of the cooler things about this is so like all these monsters in the first section, they all have these like huge number of tables for generating hair color, eye color, height, body shape. For in the case of beholders, you know, what kind of stalks they have, how thick they are, how long they are, what kind of pupils they have. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
And that's just the physicality of it. They've got personality trait ones, yeah. Motivations, bonds, all that.
Names, very important.
Yes. That's possibly the most important thing in this whole book. They have name schemes for everything.
Yes. And even, you know, we'll talk about this when we get to the character race options, but all of those ones have random generation tables that resemble 5th edition's background.
Yes.
Stuff like flaws, character traits, that kind of thing.
Bonds, all that stuff. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, and man, it's really, really good that beholders are the first thing, the first, like, section of this entire book, because it's just jammed full of stuff.
It is. It really is, and it sets the tone, yeah. And it's real good.
And also a cool thing about all this is that this first section, each one of the kind of societies that they detail, comes with an example layer and a usable map for each one of them.
Which is really cool.
Yeah. They're all done in kind of their own little art style that fits the creature. Yep. The Beholder's one is very wibbly wobbly, tiny whiny, bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Yes. And I love it.
Yeah.
I really do.
In fact, anytime you think about using Doctor Who in any kind of tabletop game, just use a Beholder instead. It'll be a lot more fun.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, good old Dr. Hive Tyrant.
I'd watch it.
Unimpeachable great emperor who.
Who's next on the chopping block, by the by?
Next is going to be giants.
Giants?
Giants are probably going to be one of the bigger sections in the book.
I can't imagine why.
Well, it really makes sense because this book was probably being developed alongside with Attack of the Storm King, Rage of the Storm King.
The giant themed module.
Yeah, the big giant themed module that's the most recent module to come out. And it really, really shows that if they weren't having the same writers kind of cross-reference with this, that at least there was a giant's Bible floating around at the time.
Yes.
that they were able to reference.
And it was very obviously a tremendous influence.
Yeah, because, you know, clearly they want to make sure that the giants they have in the adventure are the giants that match up with the monster manual.
Yeah.
But it creates so much extra stuff that they can bring in. And, I mean,
yes.
You've got cloud giants, stone giants, thunder giants, hill giants, fire giants.
Storm giants.
Storm giants. There's everything.
It's a huge selection.
Yeah. The lore for the giants is really, really nice.
Yes.
It definitely, if you are interested in kind of mythic, epic, early fantasy, like, and I'm not even talking things like Conan, where it's kind of gritty, like sword and sorcery kind of stuff. I'm talking like Hercules picking up a Cerberus in his own bare hands and punching him into unconsciousness, that kind of stuff.
It's basically Greek myth without Zeus fucking things.
Yeah. I mean, because basically the backstory of giants for Dungeons & Dragons is that they are 4 or 5 millennia old. Yes. They are so old that giants don't even know their origin anymore, just that they come from this particular god.
They came from the time back when dragons weren't big and majestic.
Yeah, and then when dragons became big and majestic, they had a millennia-long war where the two sides fought each other to utter attrition and killed each other off to the point that the rest of the world could start happening.
Exactly, which I think is one of the strangely coolest myths I've ever seen.
Yeah. Like, this is the kind of thing where it's very easy to, you know, when you first get into D&D, or you've been playing role-playing games in your own settings for a while, and then someone's like, oh, well, let's start with something simple, let's do an adventure path, and it's a Faerun adventure path, and so you're like, all right, well, I guess I need to learn the lore for Faerun, and it's mostly, like, terse political divine stuff.
Yeah.
That really, it's easy to kind of pass over, like, hey, there's this huge mythical, like, existence that should be an influence in modern day. Like even the, like, smallest farmer should have some, like, you know, nightmare bedtime story about giants coming to take their cabbages or something.
Yeah, yeah. Because they are. They are really big and really important in, like, the old lore.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's because these two had their giant fight that the rest of the world can happen.
Yeah.
I believe a line that was in the giant segment was something to the tune of, before the first elf had stepped its dainty toe out of the Feywild.
Yeah. But before humans were a gleam in Pelor's eye.
Yes. Yes. There were very, very good lines in the giant section.
Yeah. Definitely, if there is absolutely anything to buy this book for, it's the giant section.
I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially since, you know, beholders kind of have this problem where they are outright made to be villains.
Yeah.
And several of the other ones we're going to talk about here are going to have the same kind of treatment.
Yes.
Goblins, or not goblins. Giants, while they do have, you know, they are definitely set up to be antagonists, are at least very relatable and very understandable in kind of how they operate. And,
yes.
And are at no point is there the cheap, very, very cheap explanation for, you really can't understand their motivations because they're so alien.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that I got very sick of reading this book.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, giants, great.
Really good section.
Yeah, I mean, especially the granularity they go with all the different varieties of giants.
Yes.
Each one of them, each of the different kinds of giants have their own little philosophy. They mm-hmm. have their own explanations of what kind of goods they carry with them, what kind of things they enjoy, you know, how they contribute to giant society, both in the past and now. It's a good read.
Yes, it's really, really good. I really liked how they described all of them, despite being such disparate, wildly various forms, they're all kin.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Next up, we have gnolls. Now, Noel, you're on record for not liking the gnolls in this.
Yes.
You've already said that many a time. We will definitely go into that.
Yes.
The one thing that I would like to put forward is, even though this book isn't written with an unreliable narrator. It's presented as having an unreliable narrator, but it at no point does it ever present any facts that are contradictory.
Yes.
Or make you question how true anything is in this book.
Yep.
I would like to specifically point out that the gnolls, as presented in Volo's Guide, make perfect sense under the idea of gnolls that are completely under the control of a cult of Yanogu.
Yes.
If you can, and if you treat it like that, the gnoll section in this isn't too bad. There's still some very, very big points that I really don't like about it.
Yeah.
But if you kind of go into it thinking, like, all right, the gnolls that Volo has dealt with were a cult of Yanogu, and there are other gnolls and other gnoll takes on gnoll life that you can possibly have.
Yeah.
That said, please air every single grievance you have with this section.
All right. Well, to begin with, this whole section presents gnolls as, while still technically being sentient, I'm okay with the traditional portrayal of them being below average intelligence. That's normal. That's completely, I'm used to that with gnolls. However, this presents them as so far below average intelligence that they can only speak in grunts and whines and laughter.
Yeah.
They have no proper language. As far, you could technically consider grunts and whines as laughter a language, but it's not.
Yeah.
They're non-interactable with literally anyone. Every other monster in this book, just about, save for, you know, the Cataleptus and the cows and
yeah, the
oxen.
The ones that are blatantly, you know, animals.
Yes. Every other monster you can interact with, you can speak with, they have language, they have proper religion, they have everything. You can imagine them brewing.
Yeah.
To put it in the way that creature culture goes to a lot, you can imagine the rest of the races in this entire book brewing.
Yes. Gnolls, even beholders,
even,
somehow.
Even beholders. They would have people brew for them.
Yeah.
They might not drink it because it'd make them more paranoid, but whatever.
They gnolls might drink, but they definitely wouldn't smoke.
Yes. That being said, Steve Lichtman is really good and everyone should read it.
Yes. Anyways, gnolls.
Yes. Gnolls. They entirely remove the possibility of player character gnolls, assuming, of course, which the way they indicated generally without explicit, well, they might have explicitly said it, but that all gnolls are like this.
Yeah.
Assuming that, as the book says, all gnolls are like this, they have removed the possibility of player character gnolls according if you're using Volo's guide as canon.
Yeah.
They have no society. They literally just run around, sleep, eat, and kill.
I will note, all of the art does show them with at least hand-salvaged equipment.
Yes.
So they do keep that aesthetic going, and the gnoll art is pretty good in this.
That's, I was saving that piece for last, but you're right.
Yeah.
The gnoll art in this is remarkably good.
Yeah, so this just kind of goes to my own kind of, what's the word? When you convince yourself of something that's not true.
Delusion?
Yeah, my own delusion that this is this whole section on gnolls is just written from Volo's, you know, perspective of what gnolls are about.
Yes. And that's the only way I could possibly deem any of this as acceptable.
Yeah.
But they removed the player character possibilities. They completely made all gnolls completely alien to the world.
Yeah. They're essentially demons.
Now. Yes. They are almost literally demons with a It's not like it used to be, where gnolls were a material race tainted by demons. Now they're a demon race tainted by the material,
yeah,
is essentially what it is, because they don't reproduce like anything else, and they don't even have the excuse of they're a far realm creature like the beholders.
Yeah.
What they do is they go and they eat, and they eat, and they eat, and they continue eating, and they kill more things, and they eat.
Well, no, that's the it explicitly says that they are hyenas, that when Yanogu enters the world and causes a slaughter, any hyena that comes and drinks of the blood of that slaughter then bursts into a gnoll.
Right, and that's how they begin.
Yeah.
But they can reproduce themselves.
Oh, okay. I missed that part.
It's all good. Yeah, they can reproduce themselves by eating and eating and eating and feasting and then sleeping. And then eventually one of two things happen. Either they vomit out several baby gnolls, or they explode in a shower of gore, producing more baby gnolls in their wake. And that's it. That's their entire reproductive cycle. There is nothing normal, there is nothing interactable, there is nothing doewable about that.
Yeah.
They've made them entirely alien to this entire setting.
And I will admit there's a short passage that's a kind of like notes from a Yanogu cultist,
yes,
journal, and that is one of the better fluff pieces in this, but really it reads more like It reads like a Warhammer 40K piece much more than something relating to Dungeons and Dragons.
Absolutely. It also, that particular piece reinforces the idea that they are gibbering, chaotic, stupid, and they have such, the only reason they exist is because they have such high endurance. The piece, in essence, reads, "This cultist cut off O'Neill's arms and legs, and then just sort of watched it jib around for weeks."
Yeah, waiting for its, like, mind to die down enough for it to, like, link itself to the demonic realm.
And it eventually happens, and then he turns into a, like, severe devotee of Yinoga and whatever. But the point is, it reinforces the idea that they are not properly sentient. They're sentient on the same level that perhaps a xenomorph is.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's the conclusion that I have drawn from the new Gnolls, is that they are fuzzy, hyenid xenomorphs. Which, were this any other way, would have me jumping for joy and dancing, but this is bad!
Your name is, in fact, Gnollbard.
Yes!
None of these Gnolls can be bards.
No, they can't! None of these Gnolls can do anything but slaughter! There's no intelligence whatsoever, there's no storytelling, there's no culture, there's no anything. And I hate it.
Yeah. Like, the way that kind of, like, the cultist kind of interacts with Yonoku. Like, if that was a Gnoll who was a severe devotee of Yonoku, yes. I could accept that because it still leaves room for there being a person there.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because if they were a normal race, like, if Gnolls were a normal race that had been tainted by Yonoku, like, just cults of them towards him.
Yeah.
And there were cults or groups of them who weren't cults, that'd be fine. I would totally understand that. And I like the way you do it. I like your delusion.
Yeah.
That he's only interacting with these cults and that's how he sees all of them. And if the book hadn't presented it in such a way that said, no, this is all of them. This is literally all of them. There's no room for anything else. Fuck you.
Yeah.
If they presented it any other way, I'd have been happy. But they didn't.
Yeah.
However, there are two redeeming features, one of which we already covered.
Yeah.
The art's really good. The art's really good. I really like the Witherling.
Yeah.
I like some... They gave him cool hairstyles.
Yeah.
They really did.
The armor is, like, really nice. It's a it's a kind of like a weird, like, lamellar brigandine inspired kind of thing that you really don't see a lot.
It's perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
I love the scavenged look. They did it really well. They pulled off the art beautifully in this section. And I have to give them that credit. Second, the only other redeeming point to this section, if you ask me, which you didn't, but you're listening, so you may as well have, is that Yinogu was pretty cool.
Yeah.
They put a lot of neat stuff on him.
Yeah. It's a much better Cult of Yinogu section than it is a Gnoll section.
Absolutely. 120% it is.
Which is honestly a thing that I miss from 4th edition's monster manuals, as each one of them had one of the demon princes heavily associated with it and had a big write-up on their cult and everything.
Yes. Like,
That was always a really nice read. We have left out what I believe is, for both of us, the most egregious problem with how they're portraying Gnolls in this edition, though.
And what would that be?
They go to absolutely great pains to never use any pronouns or anything for these Gnolls.
Right.
So ostensibly, these Gnolls are ungendered.
Right, which fits in with their horrible reproduction.
Yeah. But that also means that their god is also explicitly referred to as he, which means that the entire hyena female dominance thing that is such a cool thing about Gnolls, that is a nice change of pace from traditional European fantasy,
yep,
has now been completely scrubbed from the entire thing.
Doesn't make a fucking lick of sense.
Yep. And it would be fine, like, I would maybe be okay with it if hags weren't the only female-dominated thing in this, even though hags are really, I mean, they really don't have any explanation as to otherwise, like, there are no male hags.
Yeah, but it's just a thing.
Yeah, it's just kind of, like... It definitely feels like there's some wild conspiracy theory out there of, like, oh, there's a bunch of furry feminists out there and they love Gnolls and we gotta make them suck now.
I think I just vomited a little.
But that's kind of how it feels.
I'd never put it together. Oh, God.
I'm not gonna say that there's a conspiracy for it, but there probably is.
I need to go have a lie down. I hurt. And not in the normal ways. Basically, my biggest grievance about Gnolls in Volo's Guide is that the only interaction you can have with them is killing them, and the closest thing to character interaction you can get is with the broken cultists who follow them.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, if you really, really want to do some cool stuff with Yunogu, read this section. If you want to do cool stuff with Knowles,
read Playing Knowles.
Yeah, read Playing Knowles. Definitely read Playing Knowles.
100%. I always have a printed out copy with my game stuff because it's a really good guide to Knowles.
Yeah, I mean, like, it would have been fine if this section on Knowles and Volo's Guide didn't live up to Playing Knowles, but I don't think it even lives up to the third edition section on Knowles and the Monster Manual for third edition.
I don't think it lives up to the AD&D entry.
The AD&D entry is definitely one of the top entries.
Like, granted.
Yeah. But yeah, anyways, let's get away from some Knowles.
A happier topic. I never thought I'd say that about Knowles.
Goblinoids.
David Bowieoids.
Goblins are, I mean, there's nothing too unexpected here.
No.
But it's, you know, again, I love 4th edition.
Yeah.
But 4th edition's fluff was light.
Lacking?
It was purposefully done in a way that the language used was meant to evoke and inspire, and definitely was pointed in a degree, like, especially with the whole Points of Light campaign setting idea,
mm-hmm.
That they use a lot of proper nouns, and they pointedly make sure that they're describing things in certain ways, that a certain idea is coming across.
True.
But with enough room that at the table, you know, someone can say, oh yeah, hobgoblins are definitely samurai.
Yeah.
And that's not gonna conflict with the books, and it's also not gonna conflict with someone else's view of hobgoblins at another table.
Yeah.
And definitely that kind of comes through for this. Like, you know, goblins have a very, they've got their cool little thing. You've got bugbears, which are independently kind of weird monster lumberjacks and also special forces guys.
Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of what my ideal bugbear is. It's a goblinoid that, like, got trained to be a Navy SEAL and then went off the grid for a long time and eventually gets called back into service in, like, a Jason Bourne style fantasy, like, spy agency.
I could see a bugbear starring in that shooter movie.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I dig that.
Or a bugbear starring in a Taken fantasy movie.
Yeah. Bugbears are action heroes.
They're perfect for it because they're cuddly. You could have a hug bear.
Oh, God, yes.
They're definitely rough, but they're just furry enough that they could look handsome.
Yes.
And then you've got, like, all these hobgoblins that are kind of running the show, and they're super uptight, militaristic, and they know how to get stuff done, and, yes, you know, how to logistically make sure food makes it from their supply train, from their farms to the front line and whatever. Yeah. And then you have goblins that are just fucking around everywhere and being goblins, and they're loving pumpkins and chickens and being great.
Exactly. That's actually one thing that I really, really liked about this section, was the three factions, essentially.
Yeah.
They're all unique, they're all wildly separate, but they can all work together very well, and they're inspired to do so by their god.
Yeah, and that's kind of the cool thing, is when they present each of the sub-races, they present them in how they operate separately.
Yes.
But then when it goes into the lair, it talks about how they operate as a group.
Yes.
Which is, like, it's a cool thing that I don't feel like you, like they definitely kind of try and do it with giants, but they never really fully integrate them, possibly because, like, the idea of full giant integrated society is a thing that's, you know, 5 millennia ago or whatever. Yeah,
you don't see it.
Yeah, but, like, the way that they present goblinoids is a really good kind of model for, hey, take any three random races and try and make them work together and figure out how they would have a society together, because that's going to happen. You're going to have multi-race cosmopolitan strongholds.
Absolutely. And I just love that they emphasize that there's very rarely any infighting ever at all.
Yeah.
And what there is small and easily managed.
Yeah.
I think that's so cool because so many villain groups have, like, backstabbery and infighting and hatred of each other. I don't like that in my villain groups.
Yeah.
I want them to work together in a terrifyingly good fashion.
Yeah. Like, if there's any kind of infighting, it's, like, Bugbear is trying to figure out who's going to be the head bugbear, or yes. or Hobgoblin's vying for political relevance or something.
Exactly.
But when it comes down to it, you know, you're not going to have the bugbears betraying the Hobgoblins or the goblins to, like, take over the whole stronghold, because the bugbears know what they want to do.
Yes.
They want to be furry, they want to chop down trees, and they want to kill people.
Yes. And sleep in between.
Yes.
And that's it. Hobgoblins? They just want to make the others conquer shit.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all they want.
Goblins? Goblins want to eat chickens and pumpkins.
Yes. And be happy, and sometimes kill things, and go out and find mushrooms.
And, like, throw shiny stuff around.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're simple, and they all work together, and they don't have conflicting interests at all.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I also really liked how well this segment evoked your feelings for the different races.
Yeah.
Like, 100% reading through the Hobgoblin section, I was like, this is straight up an ancient version of modern military.
Yes.
This is perfect.
Yeah.
And I can 100% see this.
Yeah.
Reading through the goblins, this is vaguely organized chaos. Yes.
I love goblinoids, and I love that the section for goblinoids was good.
Yes.
I love it.
I do too. This is another one of those things I think this book is worth buying for.
Yeah.
Just for, if nothing else, just for the style and flair of this section.
Yeah, and like even coming down to it, the kind of stronghold section, that map is just a really good, like, just castle map. You could repurpose that for any castle that you throw at your fucking players.
Oh yeah, definitely, 100%.
Yeah.
It's just really good. The map making in this book is just wicked good.
Yeah. Up next, I know you were really into the hags for this.
Yes. I'll preface this by saying this is 100% my favorite part of this book.
I have problems with hags, but that's mostly because and this kind of translates to, we tried to do a witches episode.
Yes.
Very early on in the show.
Yes.
And had a lot of trouble figuring out how to treat them like a creature and not treat them like a religion.
Yes.
And that's why we ultimately didn't end up doing the episode.
Yes.
And that has been a problem forever with me in approaching hags as monsters.
Yeah.
Is I can only ever think of them as individuals that operate in another unit or another society or another culture or that kind of thing. And especially, like, the entire time I was reading hags, and it's like, I get what they're getting at, but, like, I really can't see you making an entire race out of witches from,
Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, from, like, grim fairy tale, like, stories.
And see, that's exactly the way I see them. And the thing is, they've made them a variation of the Fae.
Yeah.
Which makes it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
In the same way that you'll have, I don't know, boggarts.
Yeah.
Or brownies.
But again, like, you know, brownies I could see making a whole race out of. Fairies I could see making a whole race out of. Like, boggarts, you know, red caps, hags, Dullahans. Those are individuals of a culture that I cannot see operating outside of that culture. And I would love for them to just have a fairy section. But admittedly, the hag section is very good.
Yes, it is. And I definitely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I have trouble viewing them as individuals coming from a culture.
Yeah.
I can only see them as a race, as just a bunch of abominations.
Yeah.
And I definitely get that, like, the problem we were encountering with witches.
Yeah.
I just don't view them as the witches we were thinking of.
Yeah.
I legitimately see them as, like, a race akin to Hansel and Gretel witch hunters.
Which is a great movie that I stand by 100% and need to watch again soon.
I agree wholeheartedly. I actually recently rewatched it because it was on TV.
Oh my god, what a good movie.
Wasn't it just?
Yeah.
Because hags in this are literally Hansel and Gretel witch hunter with contracts.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all it is. But I really like this section because it provided so much odd, eclectic stuff you can do. I like that it gives you almost complete and total creative freedom.
It does reinforce a kind of fantasy that I don't think Dungeons & Dragons has supported in a long time.
Yes.
And I don't think it's hard to, like, interpret the fact that I really love, like, fairy, fae stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, this really does, you know, support itself to, you know, doing a fairy tale style adventure doesn't have to be some boring, kiddied down thing.
Oh, no.
You can have a lot of fun with that kind of, you know, you got to lean more into the Alice in Wonderland style of plot structure for it. But it definitely works.
Fairies are very good horror antagonists.
Yeah.
No, very few people play that up, but they are. It's that simple. And the thing about hags is that, number one, they're kind of like demons in that they want to make a deal with you, but they're more akin to, say, QB than they are to Baphomet.
Yes.
Like, 100%, they're almost entirely in it to watch other people suffer.
Yeah.
That's it. They are cruel assholes.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you think about a demonic deal. You know, definitely there's still an element of I want you to suffer, but there's this grand metaphysical idea of you know, heaven versus hell, and the souls go to a specific place, and that kind of stuff. Whereas with hags, it's definitely that same kind of I want to watch you suffer, and that's what this is mostly about. But like the end goal basically isn't this whole grand scheme of hell gets more souls. It's like, all right, well, your dinner for Thursday.
Yes, that's exactly it. One of the most interesting things, and this ties into that, about hags is that they're most powerful, they're most terrifyingly powerful, almost El Minister levels of, like, hagness are called grandmothers. The highest ranking hags are called grandmothers, and the second highest are called aunties.
Yes.
And that's what hags read as.
Yeah.
Hags read as that cruel, foul grandmother that is related to you in some way, that you never, ever want to see. But when you do, she's inherently the worst human being you have ever met, and you really wish she would just finally fucking die.
I will say that the hag naming chart is maybe the best chart in the entire book.
I can't argue that. I legitimately cannot.
Because, like, it's a first name, a last name, and also a rank. And the ranks are things like granny,
or auntie,
lovey. Boobala, you know, whatever. It's so good.
It's like Lovey Pollyanna Wormtooth. And it's just like, wow!
Yes.
And it's just so good. It's, thematically, it's so coherent, despite being pure, utter chaos. It's great. Because their layers are filled with just hundreds of random magical items, often cursed, often asshole-ish.
Yeah.
Like, anyone trying to take stuff from them is almost guaranteed to get fucked over unless they give it to them.
There's even a table for weird treasure you find in a hag lair.
Yes. And it's really good, too.
Yeah.
Just this whole segment is great. They have a section on hag vehicles.
Yeah.
One of them is a dragon skull with a chair carved into the top.
Yeah.
That's animated. That's it.
There's one that's a cauldron that crawls around with chain legs.
That's my favorite one. That is my absolute favorite. And the entire point of this section is that it gives you complete creative freedom to do whatever you want. And you can do some really cool stuff. Because they have a very, like, pocket dimension feel to them.
Yeah.
Like, you open a small hut, and you're in this grand, admittedly horribly kept, mansion.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so wild and crazy, and honestly, if I run a campaign anytime in the next few years, it's going to have a hag or two.
Yeah.
Period.
I cannot wait for you to run D&D again.
It's going to be fun. But yes, hags are my favorite section in this whole book.
Yeah.
You can actually make... I have the same feeling about hags that I do about dragons in general.
Yeah.
You can make one of them into a character. A lasting character.
Definitely, yeah.
Instead of, you know, you've got the Orc Horde. It's the Orc Horde. It's not a character. It's a group of antagonists.
Maybe you have, like, the Orc Lord of the Orc Horde. But
right.
Even then, it's very hard to make that distinguishable because most people are going to associate stereotypes with it.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, with a hag, you know, you're up front, straight up. Here is the stereotypical thing you're thinking of. And then you have so much more room to expand with it.
Exactly. It gives you a skeleton on which you can pile layers and layers and layers of moldy onions.
Yes. And boils and big old pustule noses.
Warts and horns.
Patchy hair.
Oh, it's hideous and I love every second of it.
Yeah.
The new novel by Chuck Tingle. I fell in love with a hag who turned out to be a man and a paperclip.
Yes. It's just like a picture of Clippy with a witch's hat and a fake nose on.
Precisely.
Next up, we have kobolds.
Kobolds.
I will say the best part about the kobold section, and I don't want this to deride the actual text of it, but the best part of the kobold section is the kobold art.
Yes. It's so good.
It's so incredibly good.
It's all thematic and it's consistent, and literally, you know you're looking at the same race of kobolds.
Yeah.
You're not looking at kobolds from Pathfinder, then kobolds from 4th edition, then kobolds from some game that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
You're looking at a specific kind of kobold.
Yeah.
Specifically, I think one of my favorite pictures from this section is the picture of kobolds about to drop a crate on Elminster's head.
Yeah.
That one was really good.
Yeah, it was great.
It was so good. Because you've just got this winged kobold sitting on top of it.
Yeah.
And it's like the line's almost cut anyway, but they're about to drop it. And it's so silly.
My favorite is the one, I believe it's been used in a couple of other promotional, like, images. But it's the one where it's all, like, it's like seven kobolds running around with a bunch of treasure.
Yes, they've got this big shell full of gold.
Yeah, and one of them's riding in the gold. Oh,
it's so good.
Just, like, they look like such a happy family of kobolds. And that's exactly how I want kobolds to be depicted.
Yes. Just one big tribe. That's it. Just one big goofy-ass funny bunch of dumb assholes who are wonderful.
Just a bunch of guys. Just a bunch of lizards just trying to get some gold for the dragon.
Exactly.
Huh?
But, I was very fond of this. I know a few people who are kobold enthusiasts who weren't, but I think it was quite good.
What are the criticisms in the kobold discourse?
Oh, boy. I'm trying to remember, dead honest. The thing is, I can't remember. I remember there was just a general grumbling of...
I know they do kind of lean on the whole... like, cowardly kind of thing.
Yes.
And that kind of stuff. But that's, you know, again, I highly suggest that you delude yourself into believing this is an unreliable narrator. And it's just his own, you know, Waterdovian ideals kind of intersecting on what he believes is true and honorable practice.
Yes.
And that he comes from, as Volo being a fighter.
Yes.
He is all about the charge of the Light Brigade and does not understand the importance of saving lives via a tactical retreat and then repositioning and unleashing a horde of crossbow quarrels onto your foe.
Yes. Which is one thing I've always respected kobolds for.
Yeah.
Like, everyone thinks of it as cowardice. No, it's just smart fighting. I mean, Tucker's kobolds is not them being scared assholes.
Yeah.
It's them being intelligent assholes.
What one thing I do really like about the kobold stuff in this is, like, normally the big thing that you lean on for kobolds is trap making.
Yes.
Which is a thing that is kind of shared amongst the different small monster races. Like, it's, like, definitely a thing that's outlined in fucking goblins, too. But they go a little bit further, and I guess trap making is an assumed part of both of those cultures, but the things that they really kind of outline, goblins are really good at taming creatures. And the thing that they super heavily lean on for kobolds is they are super effective tunnelers.
Yes.
That they, you cannot find a better tunneler unless it's a dwarf.
Yes. And even they're more architects.
Yeah.
Whereas kobolds are just tunnelers.
Yeah.
They are the most efficient diggers aside from purple worms.
Yeah.
And I agree. That's something I was very fond of. I like that they give them an immense specialty.
Yeah.
And I like that they lean heavily on the traps, because traps... in fantasy world, kind of like guns, quote unquote, in the modern world, are the great equalizer.
Yeah.
Small races use traps because big races are big.
Yeah. And fall into traps very easily.
Yes. And I really, really love how heavily they lean on that, because that is a key part of kobolddom.
Yeah.
I did have one small grievance with this section.
Yeah.
And it's another biological one that seems to be my big grievances here.
Yeah.
In this section, they detail how if the majority of one sex or the other, male or female, is killed off in some way in the kobold tribe, that a certain number of them who remain will switch to the more decimated sex over a period of several months.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting thing. It's an interesting amphibian trait. Emphasis on amphibian.
Yeah.
However, it... To borrow slightly outdated common parlance, it rustles my jimmies a little.
Yeah.
Because I have always liked kobolds in one way or another, but particularly because they are a sexually equal society.
Yeah.
Male and female are treated exactly the same way, no matter what, because it doesn't matter. That's just it. It's just they do it. Because they see, hey, male, female, whatever, we can both benefit the tribe. You can give birth, I can help you give birth, whatever.
Yeah, and making it so that sex is a transitory thing, and that's the reason they don't care about gender,
yes,
that really kind of diminishes that.
It completely diminishes it.
Yeah.
It ruins the idea of, hey, this culture understands that, hey, that's not important. It turns it into, it's not important because biologically it doesn't count. Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah.
Look at us.
I feel like a much better way that they could have approached that is, since kobolds are inherently draconic.
Yes.
They aren't technically reptilian or amphibian.
Right.
That they could have just gone with a solution of, well, it doesn't matter what sex you are. Any sex can breed with any other sex. And then it doesn't lose the importance of gender as an identifying mark.
Yes.
And it more celebrates the fact that kobolds are varied and different and hugely diverse and still accept each other, instead of just being this thing like, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter if we're different because we can change back and forth to whatever. So it's like completely irrelevant. It's just, it kind of falls in line with the thing with the gnolls. It's kind of like you just want people to stop complaining about problems that you don't want to talk about.
Yeah. The more you talk about that, the more bothered I am by it.
That's what I'm here for.
And you know what? I actually appreciate that, because I wouldn't have connected the two, because I'm slow.
I am here to be the fucking creature culture's resident social justice warlock.
You know what? Others will disagree, but I think we need it.
Yeah.
I really do. It's nice that we can understand bits and pieces of weird stuff that affect ways that we view things.
Yeah.
Especially in a thing called creature culture.
Yes.
But yes, that aside.
Yeah.
I like the kobold section. Even if they did screw up a teeny bit, I think the layering portion is cool.
Yeah.
I think they basically took a lot of the old stuff and brought it forward, and it was pretty okay.
Yeah.
But that's just my personal opinion.
I feel like, you know, certain things like giants, like the stuff for giants really builds on things that were very lightly done, or beholders are kind of the same thing.
Yes.
The thing with kobolds is kind of like the stuff with goblinoids. You know, there was already a breadth of information out there. And maybe the kobold stuff doesn't really build it any higher, but it does build it a little bit wider and make sure that this stuff isn't going to be lost between editions.
Yes, agreed. And that's good.
Yeah. Next we have up Mind Flayers.
Yeah, we have Mind Flayers.
Yeah. I mean, the Mind Flayer stuff is, it's good Mind Flayer stuff.
It's real solid.
I will say the map for the Mind Flayers is my favorite map in this thing.
It's pretty good.
And it's like, it's just the aesthetic of it is just very nice. It's this weird halfway point between fantasy and science fiction.
Yes.
Which really matches what Mind Flayers are.
They are, 100%.
Yeah. And despite the fact that, you know, the planes and planar stuff and planescape and any other word I could say with planes in it, spelljammer, et cetera,
yeah.
That stuff really hasn't been covered at all in 5th edition.
It hasn't.
It was very lightly covered in 4th edition.
It was.
Technically, the meat of gameplay did take place during it. Like, that was the intended setting for 10 to 20 level gameplay.
Yeah.
That's a thing that I am still very, very much hoping that they expand upon for 5th edition.
Yeah.
Between all the references between Nautilus ships and the fact that the only surviving Mind Flayers are the ones that existed on the material planes.
Yep.
And talking about Gith and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
It definitely feels like between this and Beholders, they are laying, you know, foundation for putting out some kind of planescape setting.
Which I'm excited for.
Yeah.
I would like that a lot, because I love my multiverses.
Yes.
I really do.
And the whole, all the stuff about Mind Flayers really hits on that. They, you know, they make a very, very good model for treating psionics as a regular spellcasting class,
mm-hmm.
which Lord, we've needed for two editions now.
Yeah.
It, you know, does some great stuff with, you know, I know it changes some fluff regarding thralls.
It does.
Yeah.
And that's my real complaint.
And I feel like if you were going to immediately throw Mind Flayers into a 5th edition adventure, having 8 billion thralls would make things a little difficult.
Yeah.
Especially with mind-controlling squid-faced people. So it's, you know, so tuning that back and making it work more with the framework of the rules that exist in 5th edition makes sense.
Yeah.
Especially since, what, it takes a community a couple of days to make a thrall.
Yeah, an entire community makes one thrall in a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, you have 365 days out of the year, so that means they can make 100 thralls in a year.
Yes.
That's not terrible.
It's really not. And
even then, they're still going to be, even if they're only making permanent thralls that way, they're still going to have plenty of slaves they're putting under heel with other magic.
Very true. I think the approach they took to Mind Flayers in this one is that your players are going to be at higher level encountering a colony of Mind Flayers.
Yeah.
You're going to be encountering a lot of them with a lot of guards there and a lot of, or at least a fair amount of thralls. Whereas the approach they took in 4th edition was that you would be encountering one Mind Flayer with a whole lair devoted to his own stuff. He was basically a psionics lich.
Yeah.
As opposed to this, where it's a whole bunch of psionic people together.
Like, in 5th edition, you're encountering one of the last pockets of Mind Flayer society, whereas in 4th edition, it was very much set up as you are encountering the fringes of Mind Flayer society.
Yes, whereas they were a flourishing species in 4th edition.
Yeah.
In 5th edition, they're dying heavier than elves are in fucking 40K.
Yeah.
They are essentially an extinct species, and you're there to finish the job.
Yeah. They explicitly call them an almost extinct species in Volo's Guide.
Yes. And I think that's a unique approach to take in that you actually have the opportunity to end a great evil.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity to actually kill off a dying race.
Yeah.
Which, when you say it, sounds awful. However...
Yeah, it's kind of like that whole Rachni mission in Mass Effect, which is one of the more emotional missions for me as far as what the last kind of thing is.
Definitely. Except in that the Rachni aren't evil. Like, they got twisted by the Reapers. Spoilers. But the game's real old.
Yeah. But imagine if you had an adventure where... the party was going into what they thought was a Mind Flayer colony.
Yeah.
But really, it's an elder brain that's been, you know, put under heel of some dark elder god.
Yeah.
Or is being controlled by the Fae, or is being corrupted by a demon, or etc., etc.
And the elder brain wasn't in and of itself evil.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Because I know we heavily went over this in our Mind Flayer episode. The kind of ideals of the race and what they're set up for kind of contributes to making them this representation of fascism and evil and everyday kind of sternness and roughness and lack of understanding.
And uncaring and just all of that.
But, you know, there's always room to humanize stuff as long as you have enough other evil shit going on in your universe.
And... Given this particular book, you would.
Yeah.
Because the vast majority, in fact, I'd go so far as to say 98% of the stuff in this book is straight up evil of one form or another.
There is literally a monster in the bestiary section where its entire purpose is, it's a buffalo, but evil.
Yes. Cataplupus?
Yes.
Yes. Still one of my favorite horrifying monster designs.
Yeah.
But yes, this whole book is about evil, and if you wanted to make some of the things in this not evil, I say go ahead.
I'll get it later.
Run it how you will. And one thing before we hop off of Mind Flayers that I wanted to go back to is that, like you said, the map was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
The coolest map ever. And I know it's kind of funky, but it reminded me specifically of Resident Evil 1. Like, the map itself reminded me of the mansion map a lot. And it was really good.
Yeah.
That brought back good memories, and I think it was a real good time.
I just really like how it feels like a dungeon and also like a spaceship.
Yes. Like, you could be in it, and you feel like that hunk of earth could take off at any moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, next up we have orcs.
Orcs.
Yeah. I believe there was a blog post when we did our episode about orcs that I referenced that was about the entire idea of like a big thing behind orcs is them worshipping their rite of worship had to do with them having shame underneath the eyes of God. And that's kind of why they go out to pillage and destroy things, and that really the only times they feel alone is under a covered building.
All right.
That kind of their relationship with the divine is that of they have to do things for their gods and punish people for their gods, otherwise the gods will rack pain and suffering upon them.
Right, I remember this.
Yeah, and I really feel like that idea gets carried through in this section.
Yeah, because I don't think it's intentional.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of Zeitgeist.
Yes.
Orcs are definitely religious people. They are about the gods they worship, and the gods they worship happen to be a little fucked up.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, Gork and Mork levels are fucked up.
Yeah.
Seems to be a common theme. But yeah, Grumsh is a big eye-stealing asshole.
Yeah.
And he encourages his people to go out and kill things. And yeah.
Yeah.
Orcs.
And then, I mean, they've got a couple other gods. Yes. That get worshipped invariably afterwards.
Yes.
It basically, you know, once you're born as an orc, a kind of cool thing that they kind of outrightly say in this, which is it is a nice turning point from previous editions where the whole idea of half-orcs is kind of left up to your own imagination, whether it's barbarian tribes that breed with orcs,
yes,
or if it's the historical raping and pillaging kind of thing.
Yes.
In this, they explicitly say that orcs do not have sex for pleasure. They only have sex for procreation.
Yes.
Which clearly defines that a half-orc would be from orc and human mixing within a tribe.
Yes.
And two, also goes to the point of really kind of giving you the idea of what, you know, an orc community is like. They are not pleasurable people.
No.
They are about living and surviving and creating babies as a part of that.
Yes. And I love the fact that half-orcs are a political thing in this.
Yeah.
100%, as you said, not for pleasure. It's specifically a community of humans and a community of orcs came to respect each other.
Yeah.
And they were like, all right. The orcs are like, hey, let's have some kids. And the humans are like, that doesn't sound awful.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not raping and pillaging.
Yeah.
It's none of that. It even, if I remember correctly, it even goes so far as to say that it's, despite the rapacious myths that go along with orcs, that's not it.
Yeah.
It's specifically a political thing.
And to that point, they do go to talk about the kind of battle tactics of orcs. And in most cases, you know, they are just as, like, they'll leave the sickly and elderly and young.
Yes.
Because they know that under the idea of, if we don't completely destroy this community, we'll have more to come back and take later.
Exactly.
And to that point, the only things that they outright go into a frenzy and try to kill anything in
Are elves. Yes.
And to a degree, also dwarves, but it explicitly says that it's just because they really like dwarven fortresses and houses.
Yes.
And they would be just as happy if the dwarves just ran out and left them there.
Yes. And when they attack, they just want their stuff. That's it.
Yeah.
And I really, really like that.
Yeah.
There's a sort of fantastic, pragmatic racism to that.
Yeah. And, you know, they still get the kind of frenzied berserker aspect, especially with elves. But it is kind of nice to find a way to keep that historical idea of the pillaging horde.
Yes.
Without necessarily forcing you to deal with very, very adult concepts that maybe you don't want to bring to your table.
I prefer that.
Yeah.
I legitimately do not like a lot of the more violent adult themes.
Yeah.
Despite playing a game about killing things and taking their shit, that's the kind of thing I like to avoid.
Yeah.
I want to have a lighthearted murder fest.
Yeah. I feel like those themes are appropriate to cover, but only if everyone completely buys into it and that's a thing that people want to do seriously.
Discuss it first.
Yeah.
That's it. And yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing to cover. It's just not my digs. And yeah. I like that this gives me the option, you don't have to cover that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Because that's it. A lot of the players, a lot of DMs, I think, have this feeling of we have to be adult. We have to cover these difficult topics. You really don't.
Yeah.
You can have a lighthearted murder fest. You can. Your bloodbath can be fun and amusing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be horrific.
Or, like, even worse, you have the DMs that think that simply by bringing up these topics, they're being serious.
Yeah.
When, in fact, they're just being really, really insensitive.
Insensitive and oft immature.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I don't think enough people understand. By bringing it up, if you're not handling it well, it can be very immature.
Yeah.
And again, I respect this particular section for a lot of reasons, and that's one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I've played in very, very serious campaigns.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed that, but that is not always what I want to do, and especially not in a lighthearted fantasy romp. Yes.
I find the majority of my games, I don't want to be that way.
Yeah.
I'll try it. Sometimes I might like it, but it's not my digs.
Yeah.
So this is a great little section that could have gone wrong, but didn't.
Another thing I really want to kind of like mark home with this is that I feel like D&D over the past like 10 or 20 years has kind of backed off from the idea of religion as a thing that you kind of play with at the table,
mm-hmm.
especially I guess in the whole like satanic panic thing.
Yeah.
But like, you know, gradually as editions have gone on, divine power, you know, and I don't mean in a mechanical sense, like clerics are just as powerful as they were fucking in second edition or whatever.
Certainly, but like fluff-wise and thematically.
Fluff-wise and thematically, like, you know, the influence of the gods on the world in the fluff in the core books has been downplayed and downplayed and downplayed more and more and more. And it is very nice to see, you know, a race in a monster manual that is outright worships gods.
Yes.
And is not a death cult.
Yes. And they are hyper-religious.
Yeah.
And they're not the enemy because of their religion.
Yeah.
Which is really rad. That's something we need more of, especially in these troubled times.
Yeah.
I like that.
I guess that's the thing they kind of outline in the Goblinid section, too, don't they?
It is.
Where basically the only religions that, you know, a hobgoblin, you know, tyranny will stamp out of a vassal culture are ones that explicitly have to do with arming and military culture.
Conquest and fighting.
If you worship a harvest god and they're just a 100% harvest and fertility goddess or whatever, they're like, yeah, sure, whatever, keep doing it.
You'll provide more that way. Yeah, like whatever. That.
It's great. But, love it.
But if you're a priest of a conquest or a fighting god, you have two options.
Yeah.
Give it up and worship, I forgot their god, but whatever it is.
Yeah. It's, if you're worshiping Kord, you better start worshiping Bane. Or you could worship Pelor, you know. We'll give you the option.
Or you could fight and die.
Yeah.
Because they have this thing of, well, prove your conquest god's better than ours. And then you fight and you kill someone and they send another one.
Yeah.
And another one. And another one. Eventually you die.
Another one.
Another one.
Another one.
But yeah, that's, I do like that. I like that these creatures, that these species are religious, and they're not the villain because of it.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Certainly, orc gods are not the greatest gods. They're not the most happy-go-lucky gods in the world.
They're not, but
yeah,
there's a lot of those on the good side, too.
Yeah.
Which, I think, the religion thing brings us to
Yanti. I'm a little disappointed in Yanti.
Yeah.
It's not terrible. There's some decent fluff in there. The pyramid map is good.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like how goblins and kobolds are kind of like the same thing that they've done before. Mm-hmm. Yanti are the same thing they've done before.
Yes.
But not very interestingly.
But on the other hand, they have a full page of random charts.
They do. They have a full fucking page of random charts for all their different blood types and
cool. That's the best part of the whole section. But yeah, it's pretty boring,
yeah.
Honestly.
They're like, even to the point that they, you know, unlike many of the other alien races that think of it just completely outside the scope of humankind in a different way, Yanti are normal because they used to be human and they got turned into snake people.
Ta-da!
They're basically snake tieflings.
Yon tieflings.
Yeah, I mean, they are tieflings with a jungle aesthetic that instead of being directly associated with demons are associated with weird Robert E. Howard snake gods.
Reptilian,
you know?
Reptilian great old ones.
Yeah, just, you know, you listen to our episode on Yanti, you know what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's not awful, but it's not great either.
Yeah. It does update a lot of the various, you know, concepts of Yanti with the purebloods and aberrants and all that kind of stuff, which is nice, but...
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's the same old, same old.
It is. It is. And, could have been a lot worse. Yeah. Could have been a lot worse. Read it. Form your own opinion on it. Yeah. We don't have much of one.
If you really, really want to use Yanti, it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the first section.
That is. That's... And it's pretty solid, too.
Yeah. And that was a lot of us talking for a while.
It really was. Holy
yeah.
Crap.
The rest of this is going to go by pretty snappy. Yeah. Next up, we have character races.
All right.
We have Asimar. Basically the same thing as in Dungeon Master's Guide, but with three alternate race options.
Right.
It's basically the same thing. A little bit more of a combat focus.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
They're humanoid angels.
Yeah, they're humanoid angels. It does hint at Devas existing,
mm-hmm.
my favorite race.
Yeah.
Devas basically make up an idea of an angel guardian that organize Asimar on Earth.
Yes.
It's basically a little, it's bringing that whole Paladin's Fall, you lose your powers kind of thing.
Yeah.
Except it does have an Asimar race option that is a fallen Asimar that you can switch to.
There's that.
You got Firbolgs.
Firbolgs. I like this one.
I really like Firbolgs. Firbolgs are a really cool player race for Fae stuff.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And they're basically Druid Fae, and yeah. I like it a lot.
They're dungeon-crawling Druid Fae, yes. And they're one of my favorite race options that exist in this.
I get that. They rank very high for me, too.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, on the surface, I would have looked at the art and like, oh, it's a Frankenstein fairy. I don't give a shit about this, but like... It's a fucking tall-ass gnome, whatever.
Yeah.
Firbolgs, it's a cool thing, and I would like to incorporate that into further adventures that I write.
Agreed. I looked at it, and I was just like, all right, that's a big old Irish fairy druid guy.
Yeah.
I like him already.
Yeah.
And he's cool.
Yeah. Goliaths?
Goliaths or Goliaths? Goliaths?
Perfect as always. I love a Goliath.
Yeah.
I love 4th edition for introducing Goliaths as a mainstay thing.
Agreed. Wholeheartedly.
I'm pretty sure they have existed since 3rd edition, but the 4th edition is kind of what made them a thing.
Yes, it is. And I like it for that. I really do. They're cool. They're a little cold-hearted. They're self-sufficient, but not cruel.
Yeah.
They're neat.
Yeah. They got cool tattoos.
Definitely.
Yeah. They look like Vin Diesel.
They're big guys. I like that. They're like Vin Diesel and The Rock had an inexplicably albino baby, and I love it.
Yes, perfect. Wonderful. You got Kenku.
Kenku. I was fond of the Kenku in this one. I like the style. I like the art. I like the concepts behind it.
I don't dislike the Kenku, but I don't like them either.
This is fair.
I really don't like the whole they can only speak in mimicry thing. I like that they backed it up with a backstory lore reason and all that kind of stuff, but... man, if you want to do that for an individual Kenku, I feel like that's a good story. Yeah. But as a race, I don't need a whole bunch of fucking bumblebees at the table. I don't need your fucking... I mean, unless you specifically want to play some weird breakbeat Daft Punk character or something. Like, I don't need you constantly remixing other things the characters have said.
Yeah, this is fair. And I mean, honestly, if you want to play it as they're just good at mimicry... You can just have them know phrases.
Yeah.
Honestly, you can have them talk basically like a normal person.
Yeah. Like, I'm okay with having a fucking Tenku that can talk normally, but just chooses to speak like a fantasy meme lord.
Yes.
I'm fine with that.
That's a funny character idea.
But I feel like it's better for it to be either a character choice or a player choice than put on you by the race statistic idea.
And this brings up the old adage of, if you don't like it, don't play it that way.
Yep.
Just DM fiat, player fiat, do whatever you want.
The old good delusion of like, oh, well, all the Volos never, he only met one Kenku, and yeah.
He extrapolated from that.
Yeah.
He made up all the names, and that's that. I like that better, actually.
Yeah.
But yes, I like the Kenku in this, and I understand, I definitely 100% understand your problems with it.
Yeah.
And it's reasonable. I have a very low standard.
Yeah. we got Lizard Folk.
Lizard Folk.
Lizard Folk. Again, another instance of a completely alien mind frame, and they just think completely different than humans.
Mm-hmm.
And their entire stat block is completely combat-based and just boring. It's literally one of the longest race statistic blocks I've ever seen for 5th edition, and every single thing is a combat option.
Yeah.
It's just like, you want to fight stuff? Play a Lizard Folk. It's just really boring, and I feel like people should know how much I love Lizard Folk.
Lizard Folk are real cool.
Yeah.
And, like, it's okay to have the completely alien cold predator aspect for one or two races.
Yeah.
But it's really common here, and that's what makes it tiresome.
They could even just change the wording and I'd be fine with it. It's just because it's always their cold alien outview on the world. It's just the same thing every time.
Yeah, I mean, if it were something like they occasionally have trouble understanding why certain creatures are feeling the emotions they feel.
Yeah.
That'd be fine.
Also, the fact that really they only outline green skins.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They did. They missed out on a wide opportunity.
Look, I get that you can't, it's difficult to make something like black skins, or black scales a playable race.
Yeah.
But at least give us, poison scales.
I mean, just do it like you did with Dragonborn.
Yeah.
That's not difficult.
Or, yeah, just make a, Lizard Folk, and then you have three different little packet options for it.
And they don't have to be big.
Yeah.
Just, little, just this changes this, this changes this, this changes this. Done.
Yeah.
But we got Lizard Folk, and that's like saying, but they, we got gnolls.
And they are, oh man, if you want to make a fighter, you got automatic AC, or a rogue, or a ranger, they'd be or a barbarian.
Untouchable.
Yes, Lizard Folk were very, very good at combat.
So if you have a player who's a very combat-heavy character, go for it.
Hey, you want to play a Lizard Mans? Do it.
What do we got next?
Tabaxi.
Ah, I was very fond of them, actually.
I feel like it's a nice, another good setup for something they will hopefully do in the future. They're kind of vague with the backstory and everything, and, it is nice to have a balanced, interesting catfolk race that isn't just an animu splat character.
I agree wholeheartedly. I like the art. I like the design. I like the concepts.
Yeah.
I like them being crafters, because that's one thing they they emphasized in this, is that they were crafters. Anyone who left their view, their group, would be interested in learning different crafting techniques and things from other people.
Yeah.
And they're not above a little petty thievery, but that seems to be the catfolk standard.
They feel like gnomes that I would be interested in playing.
Yes.
To the point of when I was thinking about making a character who is a simple country Neko Nial, I was going to stat him as a gnome, but now I have Tabaxi to use. But that brings us to Tritons.
Tritons
again. I know there has been, recently, the that guy that I really love that wrote all the great underwater adventure stuff has been a huge influence lately. And I'm going to guess this is where Triton came from. But Triton are, again, another heavily combat-focused race. They get plus ones to strength, dexterity, and constitution. Oh, all of their little race options either have to do with fighting or just existing underwater.
Yep.
They do get automatic spell casting to control water and air, which does give them slightly more varied options.
Yeah.
But again, most of the race statistics in here, it's all combat stuff.
Yeah, it is. I don't like that they're just water elves.
Yeah.
That's even in their description. He even describes them as literally just being water elves.
And if they would have called them aquatic elves or whatever, that would have been fine.
Yeah. But they're a whole weird race.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you couldn't have just done merfolk?
Yeah.
That would have been cool.
You couldn't. Yeah, there's 100 different little variations on water speed, water player characters that you could have pulled from. Between merfolk, sea elves, 100 different things in between.
Yes.
Some friends of ours are starting an actual play that will be out in a month or a couple of weeks. And one of them is playing as a homebrew race called Merfolk Erectus. And that is better than this.
Yes. Yes. So,
Yeah.
I think that's all of them, isn't it?
Well, then we have the Monstrous Adventurers, which is specifically a huge list of monstrous races as player statistics.
On which gnolls are not.
Yep, of which gnolls are not, and literally every single one is combat focused.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are pretty broken. Bugbear one gives you an extra 5 feet of reach, which with a polearm and polearm master makes you literally fucking unstoppable.
Yeah.
You can hit stuff from 15 feet away and stop them in their tracks if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hobgoblin, all about martial training and like that kind of stuff and helping people if they miss.
And see, I can understand that being combat focused. But that's the only race I can understand.
Well, it's like literally like you could give them, you know, training in history or give them a thing to you like that whole that save face thing.
Yeah.
That sounds like, you know, an ability that might also you could use that in like a court intrigue kind of situation. But yes. No, it's expressly about an ally missing their attack.
No, it's about you.
Oh, it's about missing an attack.
Yeah. Ability check or saving throw.
Okay.
So it could technically be used outside?
Yeah.
But it's weird that the most martial characters, or most martial monstrous character race, has the, like, most applicable outside of combat thing.
Yeah.
That's silly. Very silly.
But yeah, no gnolls. You do get stuff for most everything else.
Yeah.
You don't get hags either. Hag would be nice to have.
A hag would be cool, but wildly... actually... Huh.
Because, like, really, the big power of hags, as far as how they're presented this, is in their coven spell list.
Yeah.
Which is basically, like, bonus spells they get for their lair.
And everyone gets more powerful stuff and whatever.
And they would never get that because they would never be at their lair.
Yeah.
Unless you're running a very specific kind of game.
Yeah. I mean, it might be interesting to play as a new hag, but they're... Again, that would be relegated to being evil.
Again, I think they need to put out a fae book.
Agreed. That'd be cool.
I would love that. We'd love that so much.
I've actually really come to like the Fae, like, over the course of doing this podcast.
I think that is entirely from my influence. And I love the Fae.
The Fae are great.
But yeah, that's basically the player statistics. They're not bad. They're not... Yeah. There's some... If you're into min-maxing, there's some stuff you can definitely get out of there.
Yeah, and if you want to play a less min-max thing, just chatter with your DM about it.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll be cool with giving you something less combat-focused in exchange for something.
Yeah, the D&D wiki, despite still being very deceptively all homebrew, is at least in 5th edition less broken and wide-reaching than it was in 4th edition.
Yeah, yeah. So, worth trying.
Yeah.
Again, I recommend playing a monstrous creature, always.
Yeah. It's a fun time. I highly recommend playing not human.
Yes.
Even though I do love playing humans as well. But yeah, now we're on to our third section, the bestiary, where we can just go over some quick notes on different stuff that we're excited to see in the actual monster statistic block.
Absolutely.
One of my favorites, Chitines are back.
Chitines.
I used them a lot in 4th edition. I didn't really like their art, and their in like previous editions, their art is their kind of big bloated bodies with spindly legs. Yeah. And 5th edition, they decided to go full hairy tarantula, and they look great.
They do. I love it. I really do.
Yeah, basically everything the same with them. They still love spiders. They're still, you know,
half spider, half drow.
Yeah, tainted by Lolth, whatever. Yeah. They have weird, crazy silk stuff they can turn into hard metal. And
yes.
I don't know. I love Chitines. They're great. They're a great underground, cavernous... I'm going to throw a giant spider's nest at you kind of enemy.
Yep, I love it.
Yeah.
It's good. Whoa.
Dinosaurs are back?
Yes, they are.
Man, dinosaurs... We're back.
A dinosaur story.
Yes, we're back at Dinosaurs Manual. A monster manual that does not contain dinosaurs is not a good monster manual.
I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah. The only weird thing, Quetzals are included as a part of dinosaurs for 5th edition.
Well, yeah, they really existed.
But by that, they are just a monster and not the angelic feathered serpent dragon.
Oh, well, that's shit.
At least maybe they're going to separate off Quetzalcoatls, or they're going to separate off Quattles from Quetzals.
Quetzas, and yeah.
Yeah. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Fire newts are adorable.
I love foots.
I didn't even really read their statistic block. They just look adorable in this edition.
They're really cool because they, like, layer in, like, boiling volcanic areas. And they have to swim in, like, boiling mud. And they have to drink hot, like, boiling water. And it's really cool.
They're great.
And they have, like, this special drug that they chew on that releases, like, fire for hours in their body. And keeps going, and I love it.
I just love fire newts. They're just great.
They're great. Also, I'm kind of concerned why they didn't just call them salamanders, but that's for another time.
Yeah. Your personal favorite, Froghemoths.
Froghemoths. Ugh. I don't know where I am on them. Like, I know I'm not on the fence, and I'm extremely one way or the other, or possibly both. I love and hate them.
I just love them because they look like a circa 2004-2005 Magic the Gathering monster. You know, when they had the whole phasing thing where, like, they would show the monster kind of bubbling off on the card. Like, it's just this giant frog, and it's got tentacles and stalk eyes, and it's a little bubbly, and just... I'm into it.
It's a six-year-old's fridge drawing, and I love it.
Yeah, it's... you know, sometimes you have to throw a six-year-old's fridge drawing at your players.
You really do.
Which is why things like... Odiugs exist, yes. Or owl bears, or
even Catableepus.
Yeah,
yeah,
oh, Catableepus. It's just a big furry swamp llama
with like five times the neck length.
Yeah,
yeah, I like it.
Yeah,
I hate it.
It's just Catableepus are just they're it's cattle for evil creatures.
It is. It is.
Yeah, we have Vegapygmies and Woodwodes, which are nice to see back.
I like them.
Again, hopefully building towards a fae book.
Yep.
But yeah, just Vegapygmies are a cool take on Myconids for this edition.
They are.
Yeah.
I think it's neat.
And then Woodwodes are just cute little Deku people, basically.
Yeah, it's someone who, like, sacrificed themselves to live in a tree and then whomp everything that came around them.
I would do that.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
Ooh, Grungs.
Grungs. Oh, Grungs. Imagine, you know how everyone, when they're like 9 or 10, they have a classmate that's obsessed with poison dart frogs?
Yes. Yes.
Because they look really cool, and then also they're super poisonous, so yes. At some point, some kid's gonna get super enamored with them.
Of course.
Grungs are that race.
Yes, they are. And they're really cute.
Yeah.
They are super cute.
I mean, like, yeah, like, so many things in this book make me want to run a fae jungle adventure.
Yes.
Just all kinds of frogs and lizards and turtles and whatever.
It'd be terrifying.
Yes.
Yes.
I would love it. We've got a small assorted beast and NPC section.
Yes.
With things like, you know, you finally got stats for oryx and cattle, which are both good.
Yes.
You've got a lot of new NPCs. They have basically like young wizards and wizard apprentice stat blocks for all of the major wizard schools.
Yes.
Which is a thing that I don't understand why it didn't exist before.
You know the coolest thing? The transmutation staff is just a pie.
Yeah.
It's so dumb. I love it.
Just literally a pie.
It's just a pie symbol, and it's so great. I turned the page, and then I turned back. I was like, wait, did I? Yep, I saw that.
Yep.
It was so good.
Got cranium rats?
Cranium rats. I like cranium rats.
Yeah.
I like rats in general, but I like cranium rats. They're a mind flayer thing. They're like a psionic blasted mind flayer thing. They're just rats with exposed brains. That's it. And they're just average rats until a bunch of them get together. And then they do the whole Geth thing where they all get like more intelligent together.
Yeah.
And that's really cool.
Turn into a rat scientist.
Yeah. It's basically a rat king scientist.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. Bodex?
Bodex. Bodex are terrifying. Bodex scare me, and they have since I was a child. Like, legitimately, I had a book with a Bodex in it, and it scared the piss out of me.
Are Bodex the ones that look like minions?
No, Bodex are the ones that look like, Redeads.
Oh, yeah, shit, fuck, that is terrifying.
Yeah. Like I said, I had a book that was all about paranormal, like, things. It was a fiction novel as a kid, and I think it had Bodex in it, and they scared the piss out of me.
In elementary school, like, that was basically the reason I was afraid of aliens, is, like, that long face with the big mouth and the slanty eyes and just the kind of, like, featureless body and everything, just...
Yep. My brother, too. Yeah. So I get that, 100%.
But it is very disturbing.
I like them, because I have a really bad fear response. Yeah, and we also got Barghess. They're, you know, your average black hairy dog, but I don't like their art at all.
I think I vaguely remember passing by it and not liking it all that much.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, all the art is very consistent, yes. But there is a lot of dark, black, highly shaded monsters in this book, and they begin to run together after a certain point.
See, I'd have been okay with that, because it's literally the black shaggy dog of England is what the Barghest is.
Yeah.
But it's the art for this is really bad, and it doesn't make it look like a dog, It's a weird sort of ape monkey human dog face thing.
Yeah.
And I don't like it.
Oh, yeah. It's got the stupid weird person face.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like the old Barghest, which are literally just the black red-eyed dog of England.
Yeah.
The ones in 4th edition, that was really good. If you're going to use anything to describe your players, use that.
Just literally read The Hounds of the Baskervilles.
Yes. That's basically just Barghest right there. And that's what I like. I like the Barghest. I don't like its art. Sorry. and I'll come back to it. The Cataleptus.
Yeah. Big old red furry weird llama cow blood drinking swamp creature.
Snake neck and horn fucking thing.
Your good old dirt mud giraffe.
Yes. A mud giraffe.
Yes.
That's a Cataleptus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's...
That's Volo's Guide.
How do you... How would you rate Volo's Guide?
Honestly... And I'm surprising the hell out of myself with this. On a scale of 1 to 10, I would give it a solid 8.5.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's real good. I encourage anyone who has an interest in monsters and in in-depth, you know, concepts of monsters to pick this up or give it a look over at the very least. Because there's a lot of really cool stuff and a lot of really cool charts and tables, which is how I rate books.
Yeah. I would say if you are... really, really devoted to running 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. Yeah, pick it up.
Yes.
In fact, I would probably recommend picking this up over picking up the Monster Manual, to be completely honest. Because, you know, anything you really need out of the Monster Manual you can get for free via the D&D basic rules, or additionally with the extra release packet for Princes of the Apocalypse.
Very fair.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. Or you can, you know, use the OGL they put up to try and find it online somewhere.
Yeah.
But this does add plenty of stuff if you're playing in that. If you're not playing Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, I don't necessarily know if this really adds anything for you.
It doesn't.
Like, you know, the new Kobold Press... Monster Manual.
Tome of Beasts,
I feel like, is a good buy no matter what fantasy game you're playing.
100%. The concepts in it are interesting and new, and they take a lot of the old stuff and work in it with new stuff.
Yeah, 13th Ages Bestiary has a shit ton of really interesting, cool monster ideas and plots in it.
Wibbles.
Yeah, it's got wibbles.
It's got wibbles.
Wibbles wobble, but they pop when
yes.
you hit them with swords. Yes. But I don't know if I could really... I don't know. I would definitely say this is a good book, but I would maybe only rate it like 6 or 7 out of 10.
I get that. I'm a nerd for bestiaries.
Yeah.
I love it. I want all the monsters.
If you buy any bestiary you can get your hands on, this is definitely a good one, but don't make this the reason that you play 5th edition.
Agreed. Wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
I think if you already play 5th edition, like you said, this is a great book. And as an addendum, I think that's a good way to view my rating.
Yeah.
If you already play 5th edition... this is a good 8.5.
Yeah.
If you don't play 5th edition or are looking whether you want to get into 5th edition, I'd say 5 or 6 is a good rating.
Yeah.
As someone who plays 5th edition, I liked it.
Yeah.
In spite of myself.
As someone who plays 5th edition and doesn't necessarily like 5th edition, but thinks it's really easy to run and makes a very small amount of bookkeeping for myself,
yeah.
It's not bad. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I may or may not reference it at some point. You know... really, the only thing I'm going to really walk away from is the stuff regarding giants. Maybe the stuff regarding hags, but
yeah.
I feel like there are other sources for fey tomfoolery that I can look to besides
yes.
that.
Yes, which is fair. And I get that and respect both of those opinions.
Yeah. But yeah, this has been a very special episode of Creature Culture.
We hope you enjoyed.
Yeah.
As per usual, any feedback, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, if you have any questions about anything we've covered, any questions about Volo's Guide, if you want us to review other bestiaries or monster manuals or what have you for other games, we'd be more than happy to at your request.
Actually, yes.
Yeah.
I would like that quite a lot.
So yeah, send any of your suggestions, questions, whatever to creatureculture.tumblr.com/ask or Pagetish on Twitter.
Or Nobard on Twitter, Nobard on Tumblr.
Yeah, Pagetish on Tumblr. We're both on Gmail with the same names, you
yep.
know, what have you.
Yes. And by the time this is out, I know we'll have a few new listeners, so welcome and thank you.
Yeah. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend. I don't know when we're going to put this up, but I guess it's going to be before the weekend.
Yeah.
It'll probably go up on Saturday or Sunday, like all the other episodes.
So we hope you have or have had a great weekend.
Yeah, and a great week. Have a good time. I hope. Yes. Play a monster race.
Please do.
Other than Knowles.